I gather at lunchtime some of you couldn't. Maybe that was a good thing for you, but if you're at the back row and I disappear from your hearing and you still wish to hear, wave your hand. Otherwise, enjoy your sleep. After all, I'm a professor by training, and I love W.H. Auden's definition of a professor. He says, a professor is someone who speaks in someone else's sleep. Often true. I stayed last week with a doctor who I first knew when he was a first-year student, and he actually snored in one of my lectures. He's never allowed to forget that. Yeah. But what I'm going to talk about tonight is, in my case, the joining of heart and mind as it ought never to have been separated. In things of the heart and things of the mind for a Jew are not separate, are they? That's why in Deuteronomy 6 you don't have to have all the words that we have now, so that Jesus adds something in the New Testament when he talks about heart. For the Jew, wisely they keep it together, and we should too. I suffered greatly from not doing that. I grew up in a Bible-believing home. I never went to school without my mother reading a chapter of the Bible to me or a section from the Bible. But it was a pietistic home. Not surprisingly, my grandfather was a Marxist trade union leader. My mother was glad to be away from that environment. Not that he was a bad man, he wasn't, but it was a depressing place in many ways. He was more educated than many of my colleagues in the university, although he left school at the age of 11. He could quote acres of Shakespeare, Shaw, Engels, Marx. Remarkable man in many ways. And he was a trade union leader when they were needed, because human nature being what it is, the Industrial Revolution in England was the exploitation of the poor by the rich. There's no question about that. Anybody who's a Christian and believes in the fall knows that we all need regulation, don't we? Absolute power corrupts absolutely, said, who was it now? I've got name block, but you, Acton, that's right. People forget the next line, great men are very rarely good men. And that is true. So I grew up in that environment, and the great thing about it was that I learned the scriptures. I didn't know I was learning the scriptures, but my mother was a great teacher. She could sing, she could tell stories, particularly Bible stories. She ran a Sunday school on her own for 35 years without a break, except for a couple of weeks in the summer. She taught a class of up to 50 children, aged from 5 to 12 in the same class, and never had any discipline problems. I thought all mums could do it, but of course I was wrong. I didn't realize that till much later. Sadly, she died of Alzheimer's, but just before she did, she got a letter. It came from Canada, actually, and the address was remarkable. It said, Mr. Postman, please deliver this letter to Mrs. Patrick, who used to teach the Sunday school in the Scouts Hut opposite the Man in the Moon in West Heath. And they delivered it. And it was a young woman who'd been in my mother's Sunday school for 5 or 6 years and had learnt all the Bible stories. And then she got seduced by some Canadian guy and taken off to Calgary. And when she got there, they went to church and she became a Christian in no time flat. And once that had happened, she realized the reason it was so was because the ground had been thoroughly prepared. And bless her, she wrote to my mom to say thank you. I think that was the last thing she understood before she disappeared into Alzheimer's. So I have that kind of background, and I still bless my mother frequently when passages of scripture come into my mind unbidden at exactly the right time. That's why it's so important. I'm in great danger of giving another lecture if I'm not careful, so I must stop. I give another lecture frequently. I'm never allowed to stop, it appears, called Why Are There No Hittites on the Streets of New York? It's actually about parenting and the importance of dad being involved in early childhood storytelling. It's the central concept of Judaism in many ways. But children matter, and in fact, one of the things I use frequently now is to point out that One of the earliest letters I know of, written by a Roman governor about the early Christians, is remarkable. He wrote to Rome and he said this: "These Christians are not exposing their own children, and moreover, they are rescuing the exposed children of others. What should I do?" Rome never solved the problem. The result was the Christians took over. I argue that Christianity took over because it cared about children, in a very deep sense. You see, this all happened before the church was organized. The organizations usually get in the way in one way or another, but they didn't at that stage. The gospel was gossiped. Jesus had come into people's lives through the Spirit, and their lives were changed. And they could not tell their neighbors about it. So it spread. And for them, it was clearly the best thing that ever happened to them. And then one can imagine, we have no data, so this is pure artistic license on my part, but I can imagine them saying to one another, you know, coming to know Christ, our Lord, has been the best thing that ever happened to in our lives. But do you think we might be missing something? Aren't all God's gifts good? What about the children we expose? That's a gift from God too, and we're not accepting it. Maybe we should. Now, throughout human history, another baby has often looked like a burden that we couldn't handle. So all cultures have killed babies. It's the norm, if you like. It's not surprising, is it, when the first man born to Adam and Eve was a murderer? It's in our genes, in the deepest sense. So they started keeping them. And they discovered, of course, that it's not what they thought it was. Because if a young woman comes into your church, let's say a single mom with a couple of babies, at least if your church is anything like a church, she's never going to buy baby clothes again, is she? And it ought to go a lot further than that. And when our hearts are awakened to join our minds, it will go a lot further. But that's what happened. That the church started to grow at exactly the same time as Rome was declining into decadence, as we are, shown by a diminishing fertility rate and a rising rate of sexually transmitted disease. The normal features of a dying culture. All of Toynbee's list are true of us already. So, oh my, I've knocked something on the floor, I hope it's not important. It's another microphone. Is this the CIA or what? I don't know. But then they started picking up other children who were left at city gates. There was a place to deposit babies that were unwanted. Now you imagine that you were a little girl who'd been picked up at the city gates, but you didn't know that. And then you reach the age where mum and dad decide it's time to tell you the story. And they tell you, you are our daughter and we love you dearly, but God gave you to us in a very special way. We were walking through the city gates and you had been left on the ground to die. And the love of Jesus so flowed into us that we could not but pick you up and bring you home. And you have been one of the joys of our family. Do you need to preach the gospel to that child? It's done, isn't it? Signed, sealed and delivered. That's the people we were meant to be. We used to be like that. And it needs to come back. Now, I went off from the home I've very briefly described via an amazing scholarship, which I knew nothing about. It wasn't applied for. It just happened. If anything, just happens in God's world. But England talks equality, 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 but makes sure that there are schools for right kids. That's typically British, you know, you say what's required and do what needs to be done at the same time. And growing up in Birmingham, which was the industrial centre of Britain, was one of the two best schools in England, intellectually. King Edward's School, Birmingham, where Tolkien went, there's one name you will know, and Manchester Grammar is the other. 100 boys a year from a population base of about 6 million by competition. And of course, they were all from professional families. But the city of Birmingham, which had a socialist local government, gave some money to the school, which was totally independent, But the condition was that there had to be two boys from the working class. I happened to be one of them, 1 year. No idea what was happening to me, to go from Coronation Street, so to speak, to this school and arrive in my home room. Master, in North American terms, spoke five languages. So this is high school. And it was. An incredible experience. Going to university from that school was like going down a notch. In fact, I played truant from medical school a great deal because I was bored. I preferred climbing mountains for a lot of my medical training. Fortunately, I didn't take attendance, and I got away with it. I never set a fracture in my life, nor ever went to an orthopedic clinic or an orthopedic round. I knew I was not a carpenter, and therefore I would never be an orthopedic surgeon. I could learn enough from the book to pass theoretically, which I did. But when I first went to university, by the grace of God, I was taken to church on the first Sunday evening, and I heard a man called Martin Lloyd-Jones, who, in my view, was one of the two best Protestant preachers of the 20th century. The choice of the other one was John Stott. They were both in London at the time. That was our Sunday choice. Now, both those two men got to my head, but not my heart. I accepted what they were saying. I believed. I never had enough faith to be an atheist, but it didn't control my life. I did. And you pay for that decision. And I lost my way in residency, which is a very dangerous place. As an aside, to the, since many of you are pastors and all of you probably have children or grandchildren, no one should go to university these days without a support group. And I mean that very seriously. You need, every student going to university needs four or five people who love them and who love the Lord. The less education they've had is probably the best, because they're totally genuine. And they need to call you every week and ask you, have you read the Bible this week? Have you prayed this week? Have you just lied to me? That gives you a second chance. I had no such support. So within 6 months of starting work as a doctor, there was no time off, so I didn't go to church. I stopped reading my Bible. And I would have gone a long way down that road, except for about a year later, or a little less than a year, my wife turned up in my life. We had known one another at university, but she's a redhead, so I mean, I couldn't handle her, really. And although I was smitten on our first meeting. So we would go out for about 6 weeks, and then we'd have a flaming row. Always, of course, her fault. And go our separate ways, but we kept coming back because she said everybody else is a pushover. So the only metaphor for our marriage is war, basically. Iron sharpens iron, sparks fly, and they can be very productive. If she was here now, she's actually in England with her sister at the moment, she would be sitting near the front, and she would have no compunction whatsoever about saying, do that again, you can do it better than that. So that everybody could hear it. Yeah. But, and she organizes my life, basically. So she married me, she shouldn't have done, but she did. And then there was a long recovery. And it takes years and years to recover from what you do. Marriage you never recover from, as far as I can see. You know, it's all part of the Lord's penance. I'm not quite sure how it works. Some days she suffers, some days I do, but we know we were made for one another. There's no doubt about that. So I went off then being, I was only fit to be an academic. I wandered around one specialty after another till I got old enough to be considered mature. But before that happened, we were both career orientated, but we were also careless, so we had three children fairly quickly. And she discovered that she loved children, and we ended up with four. That was also a blessing, because she said, you go out in the morning before the children are awake and come back when they're asleep, except at weekends. I need you more than that. Can't you do something different? So I had a very unusual reason for doing a PhD. I did a PhD to see my children, because you can control it. I had the fellowship, so it was my money. So the guy running the lab was pleased to have me in the lab, and he didn't have to pay anything for it. But he thought that I was going to be there at 7 o'clock at night, and I said, no, I'm getting on the 5:30 train to be home for supper with my children. And everybody else's jaw dropped, because nobody had ever spoken to Norman like that in his life before, I don't think. But he was strangely meek. I discovered years later that the week before, his son had written an essay on parents, and it was 7 pages on his mother and 2 sentences on his father. He was feeling guilty. I prayed for him for 20 years. Then he got saved, and I didn't believe it, because it was in an alpha group, and if there was anybody who wasn't going to get converted in an alpha group, it was Norman Jones. So I had to go and visit him, and it was true. God works in mysterious ways, doesn't he? So our first 2 children were delivered by the best obstetrician in training in the teaching hospital where I was working, who was a Christian. And it never even touched me when he didn't get the job he deserved because he wouldn't do abortions. He never had the consultant position he should have had. Brilliant, but he preferred to be obedient than have the career, whereas I was ambitious. I wouldn't even conceive of that at that stage. So I didn't think about that for more than 20 years. I went off and pursued my career. And God let me do that for a long while. And then, not more than about 15 or so years ago, a bit more than that now perhaps, that changed. We'd been going to Africa every summer because of my interest in severely malnourished children. We had a project running on the borders of Rwanda. So we were on the Zairean side, as it was then. So we were there when the war blew up, and Sally, who was on the board of World Relief Canada, went up to see what was going on, because the BBC, of course, were the first to report it, and we got it on our shortwave radio. So she was there in Goma when 30,000 people died in about a week from a cholera epidemic. She was actually in Rwanda on the wrong side of the bridge when they closed it, but she got out. And she ended up running 4 or 5 refugee camps the next 2 years. I knew she wasn't coming back that September because there were 6- and 7-year-olds trying to care for 3- and 4-year-olds in Bukavu and Goma. And her son was, her last child, was going to university that September, so she didn't come back. She was running camps. She came back briefly at Christmas in body but not in spirit, ruined all our lives as we all had to run around and get everything she wanted and raise money for her, and then we all breathed a sigh of relief when she went back. But I went out to see her in the summer, and my life was being changed because that summer was the best summer of my life. For the first summer in my life, I said to God, this summer is yours. If you want, if there's anything for me to do that you want and I can do it, I'll do it. I'd never given no strings attached commitments to God before. We all do Christian things, don't we? But we tend to choose what they are. We miss out on that deal. It was the best summer of my life, but that's another story I can't tell you tonight. But when I got back, of course, God was unsettling me from my ivory tower. If you're made to be a professor, it's the best life on earth. As long as I had grants and I was publishing, I didn't have to bother about teaching. I walked in, gave my lecture, walked out. I didn't care whether anyone understood it or not, sadly, and put all their wonderfully, carefully scripted criticisms of my lectures in the garbage unopened. I knew that nothing would happen, and it never did. I even got a teaching award 1 year, which was amazing. But that too was partly God's doing, because when I got it, there was a Chinese professor who came up and in our department. He said, I know the students like listening to you, but how long do you actually spend preparing undergraduate lectures? And I flippantly said, well, 20 minutes is a bit excessive, isn't it? And he said, you're not actually joking, are you? I said, no. And he said, that's most unfair. He spent hours on it. Because, of course, we've lost our way with teaching as well. Information transfer is ridiculous. I mean, it's all on those machines. If I don't say something to you tonight that you couldn't get from a book, or don't give you another sense of it, another emphasis, I'm wasting your time. It's much harder to do that, but it's much more satisfying. And I began to take an interest in the students. Then one afternoon, I was totally bored. I couldn't concentrate. The Augustine syndrome, the restless heart. I'd got a good lab, good guys working for me. I didn't need to be there. And I went to my office and shut the door. and I asked myself a question I should have asked years before. I had bought into the idea that abortion is a woman's issue and men should keep out of it. Well, it was easy enough to accept that. Even though I had been pro-choice, I was pro-choice over rubella babies. In the 1960s, before we had a vaccine, I occasionally had the job when I was doing infectious diseases of saying to a woman, yes, this rash is rubella, and you have a 90% probability of major cardiac and or neurological problems with your baby. That is not an easy thing to say, is it? There's no easy way to say it, but it has to be said. And the way we squeaked out of it was to say, you know, this pregnancy's gone wrong, would you like to start again? We never mentioned the word abortion. And I don't remember a woman who ever said no. Because she did want to start again, and who wouldn't? And we said, you just have to come into hospital briefly and all will be well, you can start again. And I felt no guilt. Now the key is to recognize that that's the wrong verb. And there's no discussion in America, and there should be, especially with Obamacare, about conscience rights. There are two words for conscience, and they're not the same. The word that we get conscience from, conscientia, means moral feelings. The Greeks used other words, and they're better described as moral thought. And the last Pope, Benedict, was brilliant on this. Your moral feelings are actually very unreliable. They're quite likely to lead you astray, but moral thought is not. And I sat down that afternoon and asked the question, okay, I feel it's a woman's issue, can I now think that? And I couldn't. And I also knew that I could probably express it in a way that would be very difficult for anyone to oppose. And of course I said absolutely nothing about it except to my wife. She had in the meantime set up a website for me, which I thought was a waste of time too. But again, she was right, I was wrong. About 60,000 people a year go to it now or something like that. But it includes my calendar, which is the reason she set it up. And students, of course, are all computer literate these days. And Christian students map my movements to see whether I'm going close to them, and they can get me to come and not have to pay the airfare. Or at least they could share an airfare. And by the way, another lovely aside, just for Americans. The America that is presented to the world is not a very good picture of America. You shouldn't be employing people from New York and Hollywood to present America to the world. I'd be much better. Some 20 years ago now, I did my first weekend retreat in the US on my own. It was at the Billy Graham Center. And on Saturday evening, Sally was with me on that occasion. We were having supper with two Americans who had worked with Paul Brand, the leprosy surgeon in India. They actually had set up the ophthalmological service for Madagascar, which still runs today. And the lady was a very direct American lady. She didn't beat about the bush. And she said nice things about the way I taught, and we discovered we both loved poetry, so we talked about our favorite poets for a bit. And then she said, where were you teaching last? And I said, I think it was the Ukraine. And without batting an eyelid, she said, who paid for that? And the Brits don't ask those kinds of questions, but I said, well, not me, I don't have the money for that. I have a good life, but I don't get paid that much, professors don't. I'd do much better as a physician if I want money, but I much prefer the lifestyle. And a Canadian physician had paid that bill. And she said, does that mean you refuse invitations to Africa and Eastern Europe and places like that for lack of travel funds? I said, I don't refuse, but I tell them I can't come till I have the money. And she said no more. But about 3 weeks later, I got an email from David Stevens, the director of the American Christian Doctors Association. And it said, I am directed to tell you that you are not to refuse invitations to Africa and Eastern Europe and parts of the world that can't afford your travel bill. A doctor and his wife have put $6,000 in an account for you, and they've challenged the membership, and they'll match dollar for dollar for another six. And you are to take your wife with you, because you ought not to go to those places alone. Well, I call it my widow's cruise of oil. And a couple of years back, we were going to I was going to a conference, and I saw the list of people who were coming. And we'd worked out who this couple had to be, and they were going to be at the conference. And I said to Sally, our donors are going to be there. We ought to make some estimate of how much money we've taken out of this fund. And we sat down and did a calculation. Then when I met them, I said, we know you started our travel fund. Have a guess how much money we've taken out of that fund since you started it. They guessed 30,000. I said, it's well over 100. And I have no idea who the other donors are apart from you. That's the America I know. And long may it continue to survive, because it's what de Tocqueville noticed. He said he did not understand America until he went into the churches of America. Chesterton said it as only Chesterton would. America is a country with the soul of a church. It's not true anymore. You are now a minority group, and we are losing the culture wars, aren't we? Big time. I have to spend a lot of time now teaching students how to deal with very difficult questions that would never even have been asked when I was a student. And abortion was the first one. So I'd worked out how to do it with the help of one of my favorite apologists, Father Robert Spitzer, who's a Jesuit who teaches quantum physics and theology and can pray like a Pentecostal. If you want, you have to listen to him very carefully, because the content is dense, to say the least. But he's on your side. His modest lifetime objective is to redeem the American culture. And if anybody can do it, he will. Google him, Robert Spitzer. Do put SJ afterwards, otherwise you get the psychiatrist who got homosexuality taken off the list of psychiatric diseases. Both are the same name. So what I want to do now is talk to you about how to engage an audience on a difficult subject like abortion without getting lynched on the spot. What happened to me was, because of the website, which ought to be called my wife's, I was going actually to Ann Arbor, and the students from Detroit, who are not as geographically challenged as many Americans, called me and said, we see you're going to Ann Arbor, you have to go through Windsor or Detroit to get there, will you talk to us first? And I said, yes, what do you want me to talk about? And they said, it will be January 22nd. We want you to talk about abortion in the medical school in the middle of the day. How many of you would sign up for that? That was my response too. Sorry, I don't do that. And they said, why? I said, I've no desire to be lynched in public. And they said, but we've heard you teach. We think you could do it. I said, very kind of you to say that. It doesn't make me one whit more willing to do it. And then they did the Christian thing and said, we've been praying about it. Now, I had not been praying about it purposely, which is just as good as praying about it, really, since God looks at your heart and he knows what has to be done. And I said, all right, if it's a lecture room with an escape hatch by the lectern and you'll take me to Ann Arbor immediately afterwards, I'll do it. So I did. To my astonishment, the lecture ended in dead silence. And it wasn't that anyone was asleep. No one was. And that's what's happened every time since. We can do this. We can win. Now, the first thing to do is to set the scene a little bit more carefully than we usually do. Now, I'm talking to medical audiences most of the time, and a little ironic humor can open doors for you. So I would normally begin something like this. There'll be a good bunch of medical students in the audience. And I'll say, for the medical students, particularly those who have only been in the first 2 years, if I was to say to you that within 6 weeks of starting medicine, you decided there were some people in your class to whom you would never trust the care of a dog of yours, what do you say? And now for you, this is horrible, you've got glum Lutheran faces, but in the university there are ironic smiles all around, and I can see them. I say, I can see your answer, it's yes, isn't it? And there are nods. And I say, if we took a consensus vote in the whole class about who the unreliable ones are, would there be an agreement? And the answer is yes again. So within 6 weeks, the students know that roughly 20% of the class ought not to be there for the good of patients and for the good of the profession. The faculty never know. We never discover. They lose their license 5-10 years after graduation for horrendous behavior. No one in their class is surprised. But there's no evidence on their university transcript that this was going to happen. And of course, the liberal conceit is that it must be a matter of ignorance, so they start lectures on ethics, which turn bad doctors into bad amateur ethicists. It's not a problem of knowledge. You're not dealing with a knowledge deficit. I can prove it to you. Raise your hand if you're good. One, and then thinks, no, his wife's sitting next to him, he knows this won't go. The rest of you wisely sat on your hands. I love doing this with professors because they sit on their hands. The only place where they put their hands up is Alabama, which took me by surprise initially, and then I realized it was a sort of wave coming from the back forwards, and it started with the jocks. So I went to them and said, do you mean good relative to the guy next to you, or good in relation to some real absolute standard given by God? Oh, it's the guy next to me. They're pure moral relativists in Alabama. They don't know about objective moral truth. Not surprisingly, they do in Massachusetts. So although they claim not to believe, they have a divorce rate about 1/7 of that in Alabama. Becoming converted does not make you good. It makes you redeemed. Goodness is what a Lutheran upbringing can do for you, or a Mennonite one. Over the years, that will make you into a good person. That's the way it's meant to be. Read your Deuteronomy again and think about it. So I say, well, let's leave that 20% out. They are not immoral so much as amoral. They can't even join the discussion because they don't have the vocabulary. Now, so leaving them out, whatever else we're discussing today, when we're discussing what, if any, duties do we owe to the human being before it's born, that is a moral question. It's not a scientific one. So it's morality we're discussing. Now, let's leave out questions of life and death and sexuality. Do the rest of you who are not untrustworthy, do you trust one another to practice ethical medicine in that context? And the answer is yes. But on life, death, sexuality, abortion, is there any possibility of agreement? No. So what's happened, you see, when I went to university, the moral story that underpinned medicine was a single circle of a Venn diagram. Now it's two circles and they're moving apart quite rapidly. Soon they will have separated completely. We will have no moral agreement. And loss of moral consensus is Toynbee's first indicator of a culture entering its death throes. Because you cannot have a society without a moral consensus. You can only have groups of people living together. A community is impossible. I love Alan Bloom's definition of a community. A community is something that invites high and low into a common story of meaning. He was a radical homosexual who died of AIDS, but he knew that the story that had made Western civilization possible was a community story, and he wanted it still to be true because it made teaching so much easier. He never solved that problem, but he did get under my skin. That phrase and his description of his incredible Jewish history is well worth reading. Just the first chapter of The Closing of the American Mind. You can throw the rest of the book away. But that first chapter is really worth reading. The empty slate is the modern student. They have neither the vocabulary nor the metaphors to really understand. And that's the church's fault, because it applies to Christian students as well. Compared to this audience, which has largely a significant gray or no hair index, they are biblically illiterate to an extraordinary degree. We've got to fix that. We need to really think seriously about it. Sunday school should certainly not be tacky art. It's a moment for storytelling, and children will sit and listen to good storytellers. And that doesn't mean somebody who's got a boring degree. That means somebody who loves children and loves the stories. Find the natural storytellers and tell them, the only thing you've got to do is make sure these children hear all the Bible stories and love them. Because then you've given them a moral reference bank, because all the biblical stories are morally consequential. So here we are at the stage with these students and saying, and getting them to agree that this is a moral issue. Sometimes there's a bit of head shaking. I said, all right, I'll explain to you why. And you need to know how to do this. I usually take somebody I know in the audience who's invited me. It's not easy to do at the moment, but the gentleman in the front row would do here. I'm don't even remember your name, sir, but it doesn't really matter. But imagine this gentleman in the front row has got cancer. And imagine that last week in my laboratory I discovered a cure for that cancer. Ought I to give it to him? Now, you know I'm out to get you, and you Lutherans who don't engage, but engage, because it's good for your soul. Ought I to give it to him? That's as I would hope. Now, it's not common. But what if I am a really well thought out Darwinian, and I believe that it all comes down to a battle of the genes, and he's wealthy, and I get his estate when he dies? What ought I to do now? It's the opposite, isn't it? What you believe does determine your morality, and you cannot get it from physical facts. Physical facts will only leave you with the war of the jungle. If you want morality that makes a Christian society, that can produce great art, great music, great science, you need something else. When we discovered that we have 95% plus the same DNA as a chimpanzee, I said, well, what would you expect? That's telling you that DNA is not a sufficient explanation of the difference. Not that we are the same. We're made out of the same materials. Of course, our genes turn out to be much more flexible than theirs, and all sorts of other wonderful things are happening. But you cannot get from physical facts to moral injunctions. You cannot get from the facts that he has the cancer, I have the cure, to the injunction, give that, without introducing into the argument the idea that to save life is good. And that's not a scientific statement. That's a moral one. So I say, it is, in fact, the person in this medical school who uses the word bigot that is the bigot. And again, you probably can't see why, and I can explain that to you too. All I need you to imagine, in Canada, I use a man called Henry Morgenthaler, who was the founder of the abortion movement in Canada. Here it might have been someone like Nathanson in his early days. And for the opposite side, Mother Teresa, everyone knows. Now, Morgenthaler, at his best, would say, what I do is snuff out human life. But it's a good thing to do under these circumstances. Now, all you need to know about Henry Morgenthaler is that he lost all his Jewish family except one brother in Auschwitz. If that had happened to you, do you think the grace of God would have brought you this far? It must be seriously questionable, isn't it? At least we would have some sympathy with someone who had that experience, who did not, after it, believe in a God of love. His brother did, the only two who survived. His brother saved Henry and said later he wondered whether he did the right thing, because he's still an Orthodox Jew. Henry's dead now. You see, Henry Morgenthaler became an existentialist. What else can you do after an experience like that? If God doesn't come to you into your life, then you're going to take some sort of atheistic view of the world. And he came to believe that existentialism was the best way, that life is ultimately without meaning, and you do what gives you pleasure. And so he has a utilitarian ethics of net pleasure. So an action is good or evil if and only if there's more happiness in the world after than there was before. So when he sees two lives coming towards him, one currently inside the other, one self-conscious, one unself-conscious, both ultimately absurd, when he has destroyed the absurd, unself-conscious life, the net happiness in the world has increased because mother's anxiety has been lifted. But that can only be true if there is no eternal meaning to human life. And that's what the other side doesn't want to face. That if you are going to be an ethical abortionist, and you can be, you must believe that we are all that we have. There is no God. There is no eternity. There is no meaning. They don't like that. Mother Teresa, on the other hand, is not religiously irrational. She's perfectly rational. But starting from a different premise, she sees two eternally significant lives, one of whom is about to put her soul in jeopardy. What's the rational thing to do now? The exact opposite. So we don't even have an agreed moral rationality in the Western world anymore. There are two competing rationalities. The other side want to believe that they have a corner on it. It's not true. They have no corner at all. There's no way of adjudicating between those two views in a way that must be accepted by both sides. So some kind of civility is required. I love it when on my travels around the US, I suppose about 30% of what I do is for entirely secular audiences in the university. And Nowadays, there's always a picture, you know. Where they get them from, I don't know, except that they're on the internet and all over the place. And there's one that my wife's put on a website. But they find all sorts of pictures of me I didn't know existed. But they're still recognizable from 20 years ago or so. My hair color has changed, but I'm still recognizable. And so occasionally someone will turn up at the lecture who I knew in my previous incarnation, so to speak, as a scientist. And if he's a Brit afterwards, it'd be quite rude. So I haven't seen you for years, and I'll say, no, I don't go to the conferences where we used to meet anymore. He says, no, I used to read your stuff until the early 90s. The clear implication being that I lost my mind in the early 90s. And I say, you think I lost it? He said, yeah, the stuff you write now is rubbish, isn't it? I said, well, I think I can prove you're wrong. What do you call someone who's lost their mind? And of course the answer is crazy. What happens to their life? It falls apart. Well, even my wife, who's not on my side on these things, will tell you that since I started taking faith seriously, our lives have fallen together rather than apart. I didn't get worse at my job, I got better. Your problem is that you want your reductionist understanding of rationality to be a total description. It's not. It's merely a subset. A very useful one. You can do reductionistic science with it. But there's plenty of room in my theistic understanding of the world for reductionistic science. There's no room for a theistic understanding of the world in your reductive understanding. So which is the bigger box? That's a no-brainer. You're the one who's living in a little, you know, box up a cul-de-sac. Time to get out. So I win that argument every time. In fact, when they say it, I say, under my breath, thank you, Lord, for delivering them into my hands. You know, it's so, by this stage, we've made some considerable progress. We've got a medical school class who's willing to be somewhat polite to one another about this issue, recognize that to start slanging one another is beneath the profession. It's an ad hominem attack. It should not be accepted in a university. And they've had a new definition of bigotry, in other words. And they realize that we don't have a moral consensus and we don't have the moral rationality that we share. So what do we have to do now is my next question. I said, well, if some of the people on my side of the argument won and abortion was made illegal, which incidentally I don't wish to happen, not at this stage anyway, we ought to acknowledge that backstreet abortions would probably reappear because there are always women desperate enough to do that. When I was doing my residency, abortion was illegal, but abortions were done on nurses regularly in the OR at night. It has always been like that, and it always will be, because it's perfectly rational within their world, so they don't mind about breaking the law, which is the second thing that happens. We become more and more anarchic. That's Toynbee's second step in disrespect for the law goes. It's going all the while, isn't it? You see that everywhere. What I want to do is make abortion unthinkable. That would be a much better outcome. And I think that can be done. So, I acknowledge, following Thomas Aquinas' advice, when you've got a difficult argument, make the opposition's case for them. And do it better than they can. Because then they relax. And I have credibility. I was pro-choice over rubella babies. I can tell that story. And I've already made the point that if life has no meaning, abortion is perfectly rational. And I have to admit that when it's made illegal, backstreet abortions happen, and if you've ever seen one, you never want to see another. No woman should ever die that way. The majority of them die dreadfully. There was never anywhere near the number that your opposition in America claim of thousands, but Nathanson pointed out that they just made the figures up and all our wonderfully investigative press never pursued it. I knew the numbers were wrong because I was doing nephrology in central London, and the commonest cause of death requires dialysis on the way if you're going to save them. And I never personally cared for one in 3 years working in the nephrology unit. They did happen, but they were very rare. So the thing is a tissue of lies in many respects, but it would happen. It does happen, and it's horrible. It shouldn't happen in any civilized society. So I make the point, and of course you can see them relaxing. They couldn't make it better. Where's he going to get? How's he going to escape from this one? You know, he's digging himself a hole and he's going to fall into it. But of course that's not the case. I say, that's the truth, but we've thought about the Christian side, the Judeo-Christian side. It's been thought about for centuries. There are no new questions. But the way that abortion has grown in the Western world has not been thought about deeply. And I want you to do that. I think you should. You're honest people. You need to. And I've watched it all, so I know. The first problem that happened for the feminist, of course, was that the smart ones knew they faced a very difficult trilemma. No one can justify the doing of gratuitous harm to an innocent human being. No one. None of you could stand up in this room and defend doing gratuitous harm to an innocent human being. It can't be done on a one-on-one basis. But that's exactly what an abortion is. It's a human being. None of the feminists will argue it's not a human being. It has a unique human DNA. And that only happens at conception. So that's when the new creature begins. There's no question about that. So they don't argue that. They give you that. Lower down the order, they'll try and struggle. But the smart ones give it to you immediately. No problem. So that's step one. It's a human being. It didn't give permission, so the harm is gratuitous. And you're doing it. You're unethical. And a very clever woman called Annette Beyer solved the problem. Linguistically, not in reality. I don't say that at the time. I say she solved it first. She said, what we need to do is pull apart two words which currently are basically tautological. Human being and human person. To many of you in this audience, a human being and a human person is the same thing, right? Not to a bioethicist. To a bioethicist, human persons are very subtly defined now. And almost all the definitions are functional. In other words, you have to achieve certain levels of function to be defined as a human person. And the dominant one is probably you become a human being when you're capable of relationship. Now this gets to be a bit of a heavy lecture, so at this point I usually say, wives, don't look at the man next to you wondering when it's going to happen. Capable of relationship is it's a concept that boggles the minds at times, isn't it? But of course, it has other problems too, doesn't it? If you accept that concept, then that allows abortion up to birth. In fact, it allows abortion beyond birth for many children. Some of the neat little creatures that come out show some relationship immediately, but not all of them. So Peter Singer suggests you have 3 or so months to decide whether you want to keep the baby, and if you don't, you can send it back dead. And that is perfectly rational if you are a preference utilitarian, which he is. So that's the next domino to go down. You pull apart human being and human person, and then you find abortion spreading into infanticide and geriatricide and the killing of the disabled. They're all logically entailed. There's a few dominoes going down there, depending on how you want to construe it. But they've all gone down. I mean, even the killing of newborn babies in no imminent danger of death. Protocols to do that have been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they came from Holland. Holland, the most upright nation in Europe, the only one that successfully resisted Hitler over the killing of the disabled, become the first nation in the world to kill the unborn and the first nation to write protocols for killing unborn who are judged by the doctor to be having a life not worthy to be lived. And this is ironic in the extreme. That's where we're at. Now, it doesn't stop there. You see, the next one to go down is really quite remarkable. It had to be legalized. It was illegal. But now you've got in a pluralistic society a reason to legalize it. Actually, the argument that won was the one that we'd already bought into, contraception. Effective contraception is highly problematic. Certainly gave away homosexual marriage in one go, because we say your marriage is not fertile, and they say neither is yours most of the time. We can't argue. What the pill has done is horrendous, and it needs a lot of thought. The Catholics are actually right. I wasn't convinced of this until Two of my children were married and they did it the Protestant way. And then the next two followed their dad's advice and did it the other way. One of them does have 9 children, but she's not complaining. Neither are we. And their marriages are better. The men particularly are better people. Because when you practice natural family planning, the man has to realize what he's married. And so do the women. But the women begin to understand just how simple we are. Men are very simple creatures. We have one hormone for this purpose. You have more. And that explains why we can get up in the morning, eat the same breakfast, wear the same clothes, drive the same route to work, come home the same way, eat the same meal every night of the week and not complain. We're pretty boring in some respects, but utterly reliable if you treat us carefully, you know. Women, on the other hand, don't know what they're going to feel like till they're woken up in the morning. And when you look at their hormones, you see why. They look roughly like the Rocky Mountains, you know. And both sides have to learn about the other. The women fall off their seats laughing when they realize this machine opposite them is capable of lusting every 30 microseconds. And they don't know what they feel like till they've had their first cup of coffee. And the guy says, how do you manage? So you can always tell a natural family planning dad or husband, he comes home with flowers when he's done nothing wrong. It's just it's that time of the month when it's a smart move. And these wives love their husbands in a way that's quite different. My son loves teasing me with his birthday cards. He knows Sally writes, you know, standard sort of birthday card, a couple of lines, if we remember to do it at all. I forgot hers this year. She forgot mine too, so it's all right. But not in Jen and John's household. The last one began, my prince. Now, Jonathan knows, Sally has never even had that as a thought, let alone as a written word. And it's a full page. Every year they write them a letter on the anniversary because they love their husband so much. It's a different world and we've thrown it away because of reductionism again, thing I mentioned at lunchtime. So we're in trouble at this level. It's another thing that's gone wrong. And when we've gone down this road, abortion had to be legalized because half the population wanted it legalized, and half of our side at least, well, 90% of women were using the pill without thinking. That was saying to God, I don't want you to be in charge of my fertility, which is what it is saying. So we're undermining our own house. Now, when it was legalized, only one judge in your court understood, and he wrote in his dissent, this decision is not about justice, but about raw judicial power. That's what it is. It changed the pursuit, the practice of the law to the pursuit of power rather than the pursuit of justice. Now, the person who did this, explained this most lucidly, fortunately for me, was an atheist. He's dead now. An atheistic Jew who taught common law at Yale in the 1970s. And in 1979, he gave an absolutely superb paper called, the title of which is one of those academic ones, you can get it either way around. It's either unnatural law, unspeakable justice, or the reverse, but it doesn't matter. Just put left and justice into Google and you'll get to it, Duke Law Review, 1979. But the first paragraph is so good that I can paraphrase it for you. And it describes the world you live in. I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete immanent, that's a technical term, not imminent next week, but immanent means accessible to you, understandable by you. A complete immanent and transcendent set of propositions about right and wrong, findable rules that direct us as to how to live our lives righteously. Now, as an unbelieving Jew, what's he thinking about? Where are those rules found? It's Torah, isn't it? And he wants it to be from God. Because if it's not from God, then what authority are the judges appealing to? They don't have one. So what they're appealing to is their own cultural prejudices. And he knew that. He goes on, but I also want to believe, and so do you, in no such thing, but rather that we are wholly free to decide for ourselves what we ought to do and what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is to be simultaneously perfectly free and perfectly ruled. That is, at the same time, to discover the right and the good and to invent it. Now, even Americans can't have both. You have to choose, and you're choosing wrong, as the whole of the Western world is. partly because we don't even know how to define freedom anymore. I had an evaluation sent to me via an organization a couple of weeks ago where a guy had written and he said it was worth coming for one sentence. So I'll use it again and again now. We don't distinguish between freedom from and freedom for. Christian freedom is the freedom for service, freedom from the power of sin. They want freedom to be freedom from interference. Now be honest, how often do you think of freedom as let me alone? It's not Christian freedom. Christian freedom is freedom to be who you ought to be. It's a very, very different concept. Leff understood that. What he does then is write 20 pages of lucid prose. Academics don't do that very often. You can weighing the two possibilities. In the end, he comes down on the wrong side. But deep down, you can see that he knows it, and he's not happy about it at one level. But he's at Yale in the 1970s. Social Darwinianism is de rigueur. It is the norm. So his penultimate paragraph goes like this. He says, it looks to me as though we are all that we have. In other words, Darwin is right. We've won the lottery at Monte Carlo, or the lottery of life. But there's no meaning in it. It's just an accident. But he's Jewish. He can't leave it there. He can't leave it alone. They never can. That's their strength. He says, looking around the world, this is an extraordinarily unappetizing prospect. If brotherly love exists, the ruling model appears to be Cain and Abel. Nowadays I have to explain to student audiences who Cain and Abel were, because they don't know anymore. Only if the law was unnatural and therefore unspeakable by us would it be unchallengeable. As things stand now, everything is up for grabs. So the next domino to fall is the whole idea of justice to be replaced by political power. And in your universities, there are already three sub-faculties that teach that explicitly. Women's studies, black studies, and homosexual studies all teach that the law is about power, not about justice. And if a lie will serve, you lie. I mean, what is the point of asking an unbeliever to put his hand on the Bible and swear in court? It has no meaning at all. It would be far better to say, we'd love to know whether you're teaching the truth, but we have nothing that you really care about to hold you to it. That would be honest, and of course, we're becoming increasingly dishonest. So that was the next domino to go down. And that had an interesting effect immediately. Some of you here were born after 1973, right? So you are different from those of us who were born before 1973, or in England, even a bit earlier than that. You see, every child born in America today is technically the choice of the mother. Mother could have destroyed it at will with no consequence. So every child should say to mum, I'm glad you kept me. But that means you were chosen with something in mind. And we don't always live up to our parents' desires, do we? I came into the world as an arrogant little brat, knowing that these two owed me service. All babies do, don't they? I mean, they're supposed to be powerless, but they can get you out of bed and down to emergency with the greatest of ease. I mean, they know that you're there to serve them, and they'll put their lives on the line, and not realizing quite how close to the line they come sometimes, you know. But those born after 1973, as they get older, realize, I was chosen by my mum, and I'm really upsetting her at the moment. Their self-image falls apart. All these books on how to improve your self-image just exploded after abortion was made legal. And not surprisingly, because more and more people are in trouble because of it in one way or another. And we don't even realize what's going on. But that's what is going on. Now, it doesn't stop there. We need to fill in a little bit of background. Just look at these figures. The only reason I bring this bit up is to get these figures right. Abortion is disastrous. And every now and again, data comes out that shows it. I just picked up this one a few years ago now. The Scandinavians are always collecting data beautifully and not knowing what they're doing. Or at least what they've got in tail. They get what they want out of it, but there's other stuff to be mined out of it. And this comes from a major study they did on the needs of women in the year after their baby is delivered. Because if you do that prospectively, which they did, and the right way to do the study, you will necessarily study the results of abortion too, right? Because if you do a prospective study of babies, you will get data on abortion. And the data was there, but they hadn't expressed it. Now, the way to look at it, they looked at various risks that mum faces in the year following her pregnancy. Now, if you put the one who has the baby at a risk of one, you can get all the others in relation to that. So the risk of total mortality in the year following delivering the baby is 3.53 times bigger in the woman who had an abortion than the one who didn't. That's a pretty surprising figure. We usually go mad over any risk ratio greater than 3, except breast cancer due to abortion, where it's over 3 and we pretend it isn't there. It's not caused by natural death, because the risk for that is only 1.6. But accidents are 4.24. Suicide is 6.4, nearly 6.5 times greater in the year following delivery in a woman who has an abortion than one who doesn't. And the risk of being murdered is 14 times greater. Now, what this means, of course, is that when a woman walks into an abortuary, and the guy there claims to be a doctor, this woman has now self-identified herself as belonging to this group. She is in desperate need of more care in the next year. And we have hard data to show it. This is not the only study. And do they do any follow-up? Not at all. And she doesn't want to go to him again anyway. But we ought to be picking this up. We are going to need to start clinics in churches again. Quite soon, if Obamacare goes through, you'll find you need them. But those are the data. That's good evidence of a woman whose self-image was in deep trouble when she had the abortion in the first place. It's not the abortion caused that, and don't say that. We have no evidence for that. All that abortion has done is enabled us to identify a group of women in this category. We know nothing about causation. Don't say that it's abortion that did it. We don't know that. And probably it isn't. The abortion is a symptom along the way, and many other things are entailed. This is lives being lived running away from God. That's what happens to them. The reverse is true of us. We cost Christian families who are in church 3 Sundays out of 4, their total lifetime healthcare costs are less than 25% of the average North American cost. But you say you pay the same insurance? It ought at least to bring you a charitable tax deduction. Because most disease is now self-induced, so it is actually charity that we're providing. So we need a new funding system. And there are already some successful experiments where Christians have set up a counter-institution. The law would stop them provide insurance in the normal way, but we have one great commodity that we're not using enough. It's called trust. You need second and third generation Christians for it to be really reliable. They're the best. Don't Presbyterians are in very short supply. We need a lot more of them. Because they're utterly reliable. You can't have Adam Smith's economics if you don't have Adam Smith's Presbyterian ethics. That's the world we live in. So what's been done in America is to set up a system whereby you all agree, covenant together to help one another with healthcare costs. You can't, without a lot of legal problems, set up an insurance company, but you can set up a data operating company or office. You send in your tax return, they tell you how much of that money should be put into your personal special account for healthcare, and you use that for your healthcare costs. If it covers the year, you just leave the rest there. But if you get a big bill, you send what you can't pay to the office, and then they spread it out amongst all the people who love you. Well, they don't even know you at this stage, but of course if you get asked to raid your health care fund for Mrs. X who has breast cancer, you're going to pray for Mrs. X. You're probably going to call her as well. It works. It's a lot cheaper and it creates community again. That's reversing the domino effect if you're interested in that way around. That doesn't stop there. How am I doing for time? I have no idea. Neither do you apparently, so I love going to Africa where they tell me to put my watch away if I have one. God gave time to Africans and watches to Americans. It's 3-4 hours, nothing to them. Lovely. 8:49. I should have stopped at what, 8:48? Or I've got another few minutes. Then you're free to leave, right? Yeah, okay. I will put this a little bit in because it can be encouraging to you. I was actually giving this talk or a version of it in Harvard. And I got to this point. The next domino is actually the animal rights movement, which is connected to the abortion movement in a very interesting way. And I was thinking, having this discussion, so to speak, at the same time as giving lecture. I don't need to put that one in, and it's asking for trouble. But I can never resist asking for trouble at times. And then God sort of joined in this time. He popped into my head the perfect way to do it. Because poets are always ahead of the curve, the good ones. And one of Harvard's favorite sons, of course, is Robert Frost, who was not a believer. But being a good poet, he could write truth quite often. And into my head popped 10 lines of poetry that I hadn't used for years. It's from a poem called The White-Tailed Hornet. Now, Robert Frost, like me, lived on a farm. And in the Northeast, I don't know how far over they come, you have hornets' nests every year, which are a great temptation to grandsons as to how far they can throw and how accurately, and whether they'll get stung or not. You know, they'll take the risks. Robert Frost was fascinated by these hornets, and every year he would watch them. This particular year, he'd gone a bit too close, and he did get stung, but he'd just learned what the boundary line was. He still went back to watch. And then one day he was watching these hornets. That's the first bit of the poem. And one of them attacked the remains of a nail in the barn wall as though it were food and took 3 goes to realize it wasn't. And then he realized that he had been anthropomorphizing the hornet, thinking that it was thinking, which it wasn't, of course. It was just a bunch of instincts. And so the next bit of the poem goes like this. Won't this instinct matter bear revision? Won't almost any theory bear revision? To err is human, not to animal. Or so we pay the compliment to instinct that really takes away instead of gives. Our humor, conscientiousness, and worship went long since to the dogs under the table and served us right for having instituted downward comparisons. As long on earth as our comparisons were stoutly upwards, with gods and angels we were men at least. But once our comparisons were yielded downwards into the mud and even dust, 'twas disillusion upon disillusion. We were lost piecemeal to the animals like people thrown out to delay the wolves. Only our fallibility was left us. And this day's work makes even that seem doubtful. Isn't that brilliant? He saw that the path we were on towards tacit atheism was also a path to total disillusion. And we would become merely animals. Now, of course, he could have gone back and referenced C.S. Lewis because the first chapter of The Abolition of Man has precisely that argument in it and says at the end that if we don't change, we will be merely animals. And we are well on the way. And lots of my colleagues think that way. And they're teaching your children, so you ought to be careful. Your Supreme Court is better than ours. It's still balanced. Ours is not. It's totally on the side of inventing the law, not discovering it. You have people like Scalia, who says he sits on a court which he increasingly does not recognize. It's only a matter of time. Because the law schools have been dominated by, again, us going to sleep because we're intellectually lazy, and they work at getting the important positions. So most law schools have homosexuals vastly overrepresented in terms of population, and the media, of course, is dramatically controlled by them because we gave that away. And then we wonder why we're losing the culture wars. That's the reason. A very, very different world. The last domino that I'll talk about today, because my time is up, is one that's very personal to me, and certainly this is mind and heart together, and the heart often dominating. The last clinic I ran before I retired from doing pediatrics clinically was a clinic for the severely disabled child. Most of the children had very obscure metabolic disorders which it took 6 or 7 weeks to work out, and in most cases we could do nothing about it. The others were mainly quadriplegic cerebral palsy children who will never walk or talk or feed themselves. I was particularly interested in the fact that they become malnourished. And it's amazing how when you do something because it's right, there are spin-offs in it. God is at work. So this was all something that would be illegal to do in the States because of Hillary. Because it's now illegal in the States for doctors to talk to one another about patients in the cafeteria. That is such a stupid thing to do. I don't know in my lifetime how many clinical problems were solved at lunch or in the corridor just because we taught medicine. Now it's illegal to do it. You can only do it under defined circumstances so that Hillary can get a record. I don't know what she's up to, but you're probably going to find out. And I should be glad to watch from a distance. We used to think we'd be refugees to America, but we might have our barn full of American refugees in my lifetime. I don't know. It's possible. We're only 10 miles from the border, so you can head for us. But talking to the orthopedic surgeon, he was fascinated by what I'd been doing in the Caribbean. And he said, I wish you could do something about spasticity. And I said, you know, that's an interesting point. We occasionally saw a child who we thought might be mild CP, but when we'd refed them, they weren't. That turned us on to looking at muscle, and you know, you didn't know this, that a child is capable of eating all of its muscle, emptying the myotube of all protein, so it's empty. You put a needle in, take a biopsy, it's an empty myotube. When we refeed them, it fills up with sugar, and then in 6 weeks, they got muscle fibers back. He said, that's amazing. He said, I've got a child you should go and see. So I had a referral to go and see Anjanette. And when I got there, yeah, she was technically malnourished. She'd been in hospital for several months with recurrent fevers that nobody could nail down. She just got another course of antibiotics and settled down for a bit. Very, very tight and really quite seriously malnourished. So I went back to Bill and said, well, she's malnourished. I would love to see what happens if I treat her like a malnourished child from the third world. He said, do it. It can't do her any harm, can it? I said, it might, but we'll keep careful check. Well, she was out of hospital in less than 6 weeks, and she stayed out for about 6 months. And I had a new project. I went to the literature. I said, there's got to be literature on this. I did about six searches. There was absolutely no literature at all about this. None. So I had a totally virgin research field, which is a gift. And then a research grant from an occupational therapist came my way on a research board, and she was working hard in trying to quantitate swallowing, but she was doing it in uninteresting circumstances. So I made sure she got her grant, and then I called her and said, I've got a better project for you. And we developed the first method of quantitating how efficient the swallowing of a high quadriplegia child is. It's only 10% of normal. Now if you swallow with 10% of your normal efficiency, you would need 10 hours a day of eating to get your nutritional needs. They have to become malnourished because no health system can afford even a 2 hour feeding time per patient. So we put the first permanent feeding tubes into these children some nearly 30 years ago now. It's a normal procedure now for these children. But that all came out of conversation at a dining room, at the cafeteria table, and God's mercy and grace. But that drew me into disabled children in general, and given my biochemical background, I ended up with all the metabolic diseases as well. And this clinic was amazing. I could keep you for the rest of the evening with beautiful stories, because at the end of the clinic, I was always in doubt as to who the patient was, whether it was me or the people I'd been seeing. They did more for me than I ever did for them. On one occasion, a woman came in and she had a child with a serious metabolic disorder who, to be kind to him, did not look pretty. And she had been crying. And I said, what's the matter? And she'd come on the bus. And she said, a woman sat opposite me on the bus and looked at my baby and said, why didn't you have that thing aborted? I mean, how cruel can we get? And I said to her, I think you can actually be sorry for that woman. I suspect she's a woman who had an abortion for an essentially trivial reason, like wanting to wear a bikini on a holiday that she'd booked in the Caribbean and then got pregnant. People have abortions for those reasons. And then she sees you pouring your life into that child, and it's like a slap in the face to her. She knows she's done wrong, so she slapped out at you. You are not the issue. You have alerted, perhaps reawakened her conscience. Perhaps she'll be a better woman in due course. But what abortion is doing is destroying even the common courtesies of helping one another in distress. In Europe, there's virtually no charitable giving now. It's all been taken over by the government. That's a very bad move. See, the medievals knew that disabled children were given by God. And he's going to make it all come right in the end. But at this point, he's using them for his purposes, for our good. So the medievals would say of someone like a Down syndrome child, that that child is nearer to God than any of us are. Because that child doesn't carry a grudge into tomorrow. Just imagine what your workplace and your church would be like if on Sunday morning next week, all the previous grudges in the history of that church had been forgotten. Wouldn't that make a pastor's job easier? And wouldn't it make the church a better place? We have got to learn to tell our story with more grace, more nuance, and more opening up of what's going on. The last line in this lecture is always the same. 1 minute and I'm done. Less than a minute. I say, I have laid out for you two worlds. Which one do you want to give to your children? And there is not a sound. And Planned Parenthood have called emergency meetings. We can win this argument. Thank you.